This episode of New Politics was released on the 14th of May, 2022, and produced on the land of the Wangal and Whadjuk people.
Welcome to New Politics. In this episode, week five of the election campaign and more leadership debates, the long-lost Australian Democrats are making a comeback, we look at recent opinion polls and we answer all of your election questions. I'm Eddie Djokovic, editor of New Politics.
I'm David Lewis, moderator for Channel 9's Prime Ministerial Debate.
A big thank you to our new Patreon subscribers. Thanks for signing up. And if you'd like to support New Politics, you can support us through a Patreon subscription. It's just $5 per month for the Ruby Standard supporter level or $10 per month for the Gold Standard supporter level. But whether it's a subscription or if you just want to listen in, read our material online or buy a t-shirt or buy a book, it's all available at newpolitics.com.au. And all of this is a good way to support independent journalism. I'm not sure if it was the debate to end all debates. I'm not actually sure what it was, but the second televised debate on Nine Media ended in a tie between Scott Morrison and Anthony Albanese. David, you and I, we generally try and talk up politics and election campaigns to get people enthused about democracy, but I think that this debate was a real shocker. It seemed to start off very well with Morrison and Albanese answering questions and talking about their key messages, but then it descended into something halfway between mud wrestling and a rugby scrum. The questions from Chris Ullman, David Crowe and Deborah Knight were incredibly poor, and the moderator, Sarah Arbo, was weak and allowed Morrison and Albanese to talk over the top of each other. Morrison kept on interrupting. Albanese's answers were generally cut short, and towards the end, it was just a difficult debate to follow. Nine Media wanted this to be a rating success, and they might have got what they wanted, but as far as a spectacle was concerned, it was abysmal. And while Nine Media might have won, and Albanese and Morrison scored a tie, the big loser was the electorate and the democratic process.
It can be argued that Channel 9 was the loser too, because the Channel 7 debate was much better run and a much more professionally done program. I think what happened too is that there's this feeling in television that chaos and fiery clashes are much better television and rate a lot better. And I don't quite think that that's true 100% of the time. I think if people go into a prime ministerial debate, even if they want passions to inflame and tempers to flare, they still want to hear what the prime minister has to say and what the leader of the opposition has to say. I'm not too sure that there are many undecided voters left. I know that we're seeing 25, 27, 29% of people are undecided. I wonder what that means. I wonder if it's they're undecided between voting for independent or a smaller party, because that term's never quite defined. It might be they're undecided between voting between the two majors, but there's a few wrinkles in the term undecided that makes it less clear as to what people mean. I think the moderator was probably a little bit out of her depth. I doubt they'd ever get someone like Laura Tingle in, for example, to moderate it. But I think instead of going for a younger person who didn't have the ability, they should have looked for somebody with the ability to moderate the debate. It's a big job. It's a nerve-wracking job. I don't think that she was absolutely horrible, but it became apparent as things spun out of control that you needed a firmer hand on the wheel. And of course, the other thing too, she may have been told by the control room, let this go, this is great television. Again, a lot of television executives seem to be looking back to the glory days of the 80s, where the football had fistfights between the two teams. And you had that infamous debate where Normie Rowe took a swing at Ron Casey over Republic versus monarchy. And television producers love that because they knew that it would get people talking about it. And it did. And people watched in and Channel 9 gets a boost in ratings. But in a prime ministerial debate, it just looked shoddy, it looked unprofessional. The questions were stupid. Asking what is a woman when the Prime Minister has been baiting anti-trans was a loaded question with no right answer, for example. It was just appalling. It really was. And Channel 9 really should have a look at what constitutes quality television.
Well, I would have thought that if people wanted to watch a rugby match or a football match, they could easily switch over to the sports channel. But that final debate on Seven West, that seemed to be a more civilised event. And it confirms that according to studio audiences, Albanese is not performing as badly as the media suggests. And whatever mistakes have been made in the past, the electorate just doesn't seem to care anymore. The final debate on Seven West media, that was a lot more definitive. It was 50% to Albanese and 34% to Morrison. And I don't think it was a case of Albanese performing brilliantly. I don't think he did. But it's more of a case of the electorate not wanting Scott Morrison anymore. And the media has also given up on that idea that no one knows who Anthony Albanese is. And that rhetoric can only last for so long if the public can see that it's no longer true. You can't keep saying that the opposition leader is supposedly an unknown leader when he's preferred Prime Minister in several polls. And if he's so bad, well, why are studio audiences preferring him over Scott Morrison?
It is about Morrison's usefulness to the various vested interests. Albanese isn't as useful to them. So the lies, the misconceptions and the beliefs go around. I was talking to a gentleman the other day and he said, oh, but Labor aren't as good economic managers. And I went through the whole record of stuff. And he just wasn't aware that the budget debt comes mostly from Liberal Party spending, with nearly to $1 trillion in debt, with nothing to show for it. And I explained that when Kevin Rudd handed out the $1,000 payments and built the halls, etc., that money actually stimulated the economy and we avoided the GFC. And the guy I was talking to sort of nodded his head and said, yeah, when you put it like that, you know, you're right. And it's because the media is trying to push the line that Labor just spend, and tax, whereas the Liberal Party is much more sober and controlled, when in fact it's the other way around. The Liberal Party spend, and the highest taxing governments have been the Abbott government, the Howard government, and the Morrison government. So it becomes upside-down world. And of course, it's been pointed out a million times and should continually be pointed out. The mass media or the mainstream media is owned by people who have vested interests in other industries or are controlled by senior members of the Liberal Party. So Labor always has this battle in the mainstream media. Doesn't stop good work happening, but the bias certainly flows one way.
Well, it also seems that the mainstream media has decided that if attacking the leader isn't working anymore, and it certainly hasn't been working throughout this campaign, it's time to start attacking the local candidates. Over in Perth, the Labor candidate for Swan, Zanita Mascarenhas, she had her name plastered all over the front page of the West Australian, and the headline says, Star Labor Candidate Linked to Carbon Tax. And this is because she was part of a climate action group that advocates for a price on emissions. She's running in a marginal seat and is likely to pick up the seat of Swan. At the same time, the newspaper was also highlighting the Liberal Party MP, Celia Hammond, in the seat of Curtin, who is struggling against an independent candidate, arguing that more should be done on climate change. So we're seeing right-wing interests attacking Labor and then trying to save a seat for the Liberal Party all on the same day. And nowhere do we see any mention in the West Australian newspaper that their owner, Kerry Stokes, is the owner of many mineral resource and petrochemical assets and is heavily favoured by the absence of a carbon tax. But this sort of approach is happening in quite a lot of the mainstream media in other states around Australia. We're seeing it with the Keep Josh campaign in Victoria. We're seeing it in New South Wales. We're seeing it in Queensland as well. It's almost like the mainstream media interests, they cannot give up on this government, even when it seems like it might be far too late for them. And they will keep trying, but it just seems that the high-level media support for this government just isn't going to make that much difference at this election.
The other thing too, which is not fully commented on in the media all the time, is that the Liberal Party is in complete disarray. In New South Wales, it has been sued over pre-selection. And Nikki Saffer pointed out today that the really embattled safe seats are held by the moderate wing of the party, Kooyong, Josh Frydenberg, Goldstein, Tim Wilson. Now, we can argue how moderate they actually are. Frydenberg is not moderate whatsoever. But it seems that the strategy is to plant Morrison types, Pentecostal Christians who are a bit more socially extreme, into seats to try and win Western Melbourne, Western Sydney, Brisbane and outer Brisbane, and to get rid of candidates who don't fit into that mould. I think there's something in that. So the Liberal Party itself is in a very severe and bitter civil war.
The key messaging for Albanese this week has been that he'll partner up with the state premiers, and this is in contrast with the Prime Minister, who primarily attacked Labor premiers in Western Australia, Victoria and Queensland during most of the pandemic and lauded the achievements of the Liberal state premiers. Josh Frydenberg also attacked the Victoria government during the pandemic, and he'll soon find out the merits of taking on that type of strategy. The issue here is that people remember these types of attacks on the population of each of these states and generally don't like this kind of behaviour, and it's not a great political strategy either. My feeling is that people have just had enough of all of this constant negativity. Morrison has doubled down on transgender kids, and as we've reported in previous episodes of New Politics, this isn't about winning the seat of Warringah, where the Liberal Party candidate in that seat, Catherine Deaves, she's been saying some pretty offensive things about transgender kids and supported by Scott Morrison. This is all about trying to win seats in other areas such as Parramatta and in Penrith and possibly in interstate as well. But trying to push this divisive and offensive message that targets an already marginalised group in the hope of winning two or three seats that they're not likely to win anyway and possibly cause losses in other seats, it's a pretty strange type of strategy to adopt in an election campaign.
It's a high risk, extremely high risk, because to lose those seats, which are your foundation, you're not going to replace them quickly. For 1% or 2% gain in outer Melbourne or outer Perth, and the Liberal Party, as far as I can tell, and you've been on the ground there, Eddie, so you'd probably be able to confirm or deny this, have absolutely no chance. I was told by a Western Australian the other day that the only person hated more than Scott Morrison is Clive Palmer in Western Australia, and that's across the board, and that Western Australians are waiting with cricket bats, baseball bats, crowbars, the lot. It's a very high-risk strategy to take over the party. Now, if it works, Australia goes that little bit further down the road to a theocracy, and it's a generation or two generations away before it happens, but it'll happen. And in the short term, we start to see the ugly old Australia rise up again. The racist, homophobic, anti-trans, anti-difference, conformist, monocultural Australia, not the Australia that we've had up to recently and still exists in some form today. We really are at a crossroads here.
And the media keeps suggesting that Morrison is a wonderful campaigner, and I guess they've got the right to say that after he won the 2019 federal election. But that was the last election. This election campaign is totally different. It's almost like it's all bark and no bite. Morrison keeps pushing all of those culture war issues that don't really matter to that many people. He's attacking transgender kids. He's talking about religious discrimination laws being introduced in the next term of parliament. And now he's gone all Donald Trump and started attacking barristers and lawyers.
I have serious criticisms of the New South Wales ICAC model. I've never been a fan of how it's conducted itself. And I don't care if barristers and lawyers and others up there in Macquarie Street sitting around in the barristers' chambers disagree with me. They disagree with me all the time. I've never had much truck with them over the course of my entire political career. I'll leave them to their jabos and all the rest of it.
David, some of my best friends are barristers and lawyers, and I don't think they've got much truck with the Prime Minister either. But I'm pretty sure that he'll change his tune on lawyers and barristers if he ever has to front up to a federal anti-corruption body in the future. But all of this is part of a very weird campaign. Personally, I don't think campaigns are the be-all and end-all. Primarily, they're the icing on the cake of the election cycle, and they might be critical in a close election. Albanese hasn't had a brilliant campaign. He did make a few mistakes and he was actually missing for a week. But it might be one of those elections where people made up their minds a long, long time ago, way before the campaign even commenced.
There's a lot of dislike for the Prime Minister. I also think that in this sort of everyday, everyman personality he tries to exude, the whole idea of not having much truck for lawyers and barristers is that anti-elitist thing that he tries to project. Without really thinking through the implications, more than half the parliament are lawyers and a good percentage of those are barristers. It's always been that way. Also, it doesn't make him look honest and upright and ethical and full of integrity either. So there's that. And of course, you're allowed and you should criticize public bodies. No public body is above fair and reasonable criticism, whether that's ICAC, whether it's the New South Wales Police, whether it's the Tax Office, whether it's the Australian Electoral Commission, whether it's the hospital, whether it's your local school. It's okay to criticize them. But for the Prime Minister to start to undermine the justice system in Australia is extraordinary, and it's not a good look. Now, as to the broader issue of campaigning, I don't think there's been a good Liberal campaign since probably 2004. And I think that if they had a proper media, they would have reformed 10 years ago. We wouldn't have had the Tony Abbott years, we wouldn't have had the Malcolm Turnbull years, and we wouldn't have had the Morrison years, because the media would have held them to account in a more effective way. So it becomes really interesting. Labor has had a pretty decent campaign with some setbacks and some gaffes that I don't think anyone cares about. I think, again, the media is losing this campaign. There's a lot of disaffection about the endless gotcha questions that nobody cares about and which have been lampooned brilliantly by outlets like The Chaser and The Shovel and The Batuta Advocate. This is where the Liberal attempt to disengage people has failed. They want people to think, it's the same, it's all the same. Labor has managed to get through some points of difference, let alone the teal independence in particular. And so the tactic of, it's all the same, you may as well just vote for the status quo, has failed. And I think that's been at the heart of the last few election campaigns. You know, what's the point of voting for the other side? They're all the same. I think the Prime Minister's low, not non-existent, but low popularity amongst the disengaged must be a worry. And of course, just to go back to this, the divided civil war that they're barely concealing, which is going to explode after the election, whether they win or lose.
One issue that has come up over the past few days is that idea of a 5.1% pay rise for low-income workers, and representing low-income workers and trying to boost their wages is one of the key reasons for Labor's existence. And this is also linked to that recent 5.1% inflation rate. And you'd think that pushing for a wages rise during an election campaign would actually be a good idea. David, you and I are lowly paid journalists and political commentators, but I'd put up my hand for a 5% pay rise every day of the week. If it did happen every day of the week, I'd be very, very happy. But Scott Morrison and many in the mainstream media are deriding this push for wage increases. And much of this debate has been counterintuitive. If the economy is as good as Scott Morrison says it is, and in my mind, it isn't, of course he should be supporting a pay rise, but he isn't. He also suggested that Albanese is a loose unit, again bringing up a personal attack and suggesting Albanese might be mentally unstable. And to call Albanese a loose unit when he's got the calibre of people such as Barnaby Joyce and Michaelia Cash in his own cabinet is a little bit rich. But there's also been a suggestion that we might look back at this time and decide that this is the moment that the Liberal Party lost the election. And I think it's a bit too early to suggest that, but arguing against a 5.1% pay rise for the lowest paid workers during an election campaign might not be the right thing to do.
It's $35 a week, which if you're on $211,000, which I think is the base pay for a backbencher in government, is nothing. But if you're on $50,000 a year, it really is a difference between total discomfort and a bit less discomfort. $70 a fortnight makes a huge difference just to be able to have a takeaway dinner one night. And let's not forget, this is before tax. So it probably goes down to about $55 a fortnight, something like that. I haven't done the calculations. It's not a lot of money. And of course, employers don't want to pay any extra. And I do understand that. But again, Wages are one of those things that continually give you return. Even though it's an outgo with no direct return, there's loyalty, there's better productivity, there's more money coming in because your employees have a bit more money to spend. And the other thing that's pointed out, you give tax cuts to the wealthy, they bank them, they put them away, the money stays with them. Or you give a pay rise to the lesser paid, the money goes back into the economy and stimulates the economy. It again is one of those things that makes sense, and that the Prime Minister is arguing against it is extraordinary. And also media outlets arguing that the leader of the Labour Party shouldn't be arguing for a pay rise, and that it's irresponsible and something that the leader of the Labour Party shouldn't be doing, just baffles me. It'd be like criticising Adam Bent for wanting to reduce emissions. Of course he does, even if you don't agree with it. That's why the party was formed. That's why the party exists. It's not that hard. But it seems to be for some journalists.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au, and you can now support New Politics through Patreon. Up next, the return of the Australian Democrats.
We've been featuring some of the independents and new political parties over the past few months, but this time it's an old party that's making a comeback, and it's the Australian Democrats. Those with long memories will remember the Australian Democrats attracted a great deal of criticism in 2000 when they supported the GST package presented by John Howard and Peter Costello, and they ended up getting a lot of the blame for that, even though it wasn't their legislation. The federal branch of the party was deregistered in 2015, but they've since been re-registered, and now they're fielding candidates in five states. They've got a long way to go to catch up to the halcyon days in the late 1990s when they held nine Senate seats, but everything needs to start somewhere.
Like all of the interviews we've done, I enjoyed this one. I think that the Democrats may come back. I do want to amend something I said. I think it was in the last podcast where I said minor parties have a shelf life of about 20 years. And I stated the Democrats in that. They may be about to prove me wrong. I'm happy to be wrong when it can be shown I'm wrong. It may take an election or two for them to get back to even having a seat. They may win a couple of seats in this election. I guess the lesson is that you should never write anybody off. And that's true if it's the Democrats, the Democratic Labor Party, or any other allegedly gone political party that just needs the right combination of people and enthusiasm to come back.
The Australian Democrats are running candidates in five states. Elena Mitchell is the candidate in Western Australia. Steve Beattie is the candidate in New South Wales. And David Lewis caught up with them to talk about the federal election.
And welcome to Elena and Steve. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Dave. It's wonderful to be here.
Hello.
You're running with the Australian Democrats. Did the Democrats go away and come back, or have they always been around?
We've always been around. I think from the public perception is that we disappeared and now we're making a, you know, incredible comeback. But the organisation itself never packed up and went home or anything. You know, we can trace a direct line from Don Chipp through to our current national president, Lynn Allison, who is herself a former senator. We did lose our parliamentary representation, and we did in the mid-2010s lose our registration as a political party, but as an organisation we have maintained our existence, and we were deregistered only briefly and then sort of, you know, got re-registered in time for the 2019 election, and we've been building on that ever since.
Have your aims as a party remained the same from 1977 when it was formed, which was, of course, broadly to keep the bastards honest and to act as a moderating voice in the Senate primarily? Is that still the aim of the Democrats?
Absolutely. I mean, our raison d'etre is still keep the bastards honest, and in this election in particular, we are running, to be that moderating voice in the Senate and, to return to where we left off and continue the work that Don Chipp started. The values, our philosophy, our aims as a party remain unchanged for the last 45 years.
It might be argued that the Democrats have a tarnished image. The GST, in the view of a lot of people and a lot of members, sold out the party for the GST. A lot of infighting after then, a lack of focus. The last time the Democrats were prominent, this was the image that was coming through. If that's a valid concern, have you addressed them? If it's not a valid concern, what would you say to that?
Oh, sure. So, yeah, we do get the occasional pushback from people about the GST. I don't think the GST itself, it's what everybody remembers, and that there's sort of this argument that, oh, you backed the GST and then destroyed yourselves. But the GST was passed in 2000 and the party didn't leave Parliament for another 8 years. So if we instantly destroyed ourselves by backing the GST, it took a really long time to take effect. As you mentioned, it really was the infighting and the perception that we had stopped doing what our mission was, which, as we said earlier, was keep the bastards honest. The moment we looked as though we were concerned only with ourselves and our infighting and not actually championing the interests of the Australian people, I think that was when our support collapsed. It wasn't necessarily the GST. And I think we could argue that the GST, it's been in for 20 years. It is the last piece of major tax reform this country's managed to achieve. I don't think it was history has proven it. It's not been the divisive sort of economy wrecking, lifestyle wrecking tax reform that some people seem to think that it was. Like, there's no, because I came to the party quite late. I joined in 2018. So all of that stuff for me as a member is ancient history. And so it was really surprising to me the first time I got asked about the GST, because as a 20 something, when it was passed, I didn't see it as a major issue. I do think that we got the policy right in that we made the GST fairer. We improved the legislation that Howard was trying to pass. I don't think we necessarily got the politics right, but that's looking back as someone who was not involved in any of that process. And, I'm commenting on the actions and processes that, people like my national president, Lynn Allison, were involved in at the time. And, Lynn's been quite clear from her position as someone who voted for the GST that the Democrats were doing the right thing by the nation. And she doesn't recuse from the party supporting the GST at the time.
Elena, if I could add just quickly, as someone who has been working in small businesses throughout that whole period, the GST greatly simplified our sales tax regime right across the economy. Trying to manage and track and set and pay sales tax was a really big pain in the ass for small businesses. The GST is much easier to understand. It's much easier for customers to predict and understand. It's much easier to administer. And in the process, it resolved a major constitutional funding crisis for the states. As you say, it still holds up really, really well 20 years later. It's not perfect. I think we had hoped that things like payroll tax and stamp duties would have gone in the process, and they're still hanging around. Was every item that we wanted exempted? No. And we've seen some tinkering with that over time, which has been good. But by and large, the GST still stands up as a pretty strong piece of tax reform.
So what about the infighting? There was a brisk turnover of leadership for a while there. Have things settled down within the party?
Definitely, yes. I mean, I have joked with others that the Democrats were always sort of front runners on issues, and we were definitely trailblazers in the political infighting and turning over of leaders, which Labor and then the Liberals took over after we sort of paved that path for them. And all political parties go through this. All political parties have disagreements on things. The Democrats right now in this election, we have the highest level of membership that we've had for some time. And we are united. I mean, we have robust discussions about policy. We do have disagreements on the detail and on the end, how things can and should be implemented. But in terms of factional warfare, we are, I think, quite united. And it's really refreshing to see. I mean, when I joined the Democrats, it took me quite some time to actually commit to joining as a, you know, as someone who coming to a certain stage of my political awakening and my political journey. And in my mind, I was only ever going to join one political party, so I had to get it right. So that's why I considered for a long time. But having joined, I have no regrets. I've spent the last 3 years volunteering for the party and working solely to get the party returned to Parliament. And it's been a really transformative experience for me. It's been hard work, but I've enjoyed every second of it.
So what do you see as the future of the Democrats? As a party for the House of Review, or do you see it moving into the lower house? So it was always one of the unspoken aims that they would get lower house representation. There is an argument that Don Chipp saw it as his way of getting back into the front bench after he'd been sacked by Malcolm Fraser. Whether that's right or not, there was no documented evidence on that. But what do you see as the future of the Democrats?
Oh, definitely. I mean, our home, I should say, has always been the Senate, you know, and serving that role of review. But, you know, so step one, return to Parliament, keep the bastards honest. But definitely step two, we would like to move into the lower house. I mean, our first female parliamentary leader, Janine Haynes, had a crack at it in the late 80s and sadly didn't make it. Ironically, I think had she run in Mayo, she probably would have succeeded. And I mean, I think you guys have commented on your podcast in the past how difficult it is for minor parties to crack the House of Reps. Mm. And so definitely we would like to take back the balance of power in the Senate, but we would definitely love to get into the House of Reps. And I have, you know, and again, I have to stress that this is not currently sort of party policy or party intention, but I'd love to live long enough to see the Democrats as a party of government. And I'm in my 40s, so it's a stretch goal.
The other thing that I'd throw in there is that's speaking about the party at a federal level. And obviously we're in the midst of a federal election, so that makes sense. But I think you're also going to see Australian Democrats candidates, and we do have one standing in Eden Monaro in this election, I will say, in New South Wales. But I think there's also the very real probability and indeed plans that you'll see Australian Democrat candidates standing for local council, standing for university councils, student council representatives in various universities, that you'll see them standing for state parliament in lower house and upper house seats right across the board. And then, you know, in 2025, I fully expect to see more lower house candidates across the country, maybe not in 151 electorates across the country, but certainly in a lot more than the one that we've got this time around, which was a very targeted, personal, I'm going to run for my community type of event. But I fully expect to see much broader candidacy for the Democrats, at least right across the three levels of government.
Yeah, we particularly, because I'm in WA, we see an extraordinary opportunity for us at state level at the next WA state election, because the Mark McGowan tsunami has to recede.
Four seats and we're in opposition, Elena.
Exactly. But I should also point out one of our young Democrats is currently holding the balance of power on his student council. I think it's at the University of Sydney.
UTS.
Oh, UTS. Thank you. Yes. So, he's finding that fascinating and challenging.
It's how the American right won its massive influence over the last, by just going small and building from
school
there.
School boards, than local education boards, the judiciary, the sheriff's office, the library boards. Library boards are having an enormous impact in places like Texas and the South at the moment, you know, with their book bannings on anything that might touch on race or gender. You know, like there's, and not, obviously that's not how we're going about it, but that idea of sort of lower levels of democratic representation bubbling up to a federal level rather than trying to begin at a federal level necessarily. At the same time, for us, our home really does feel like the Australian Senate, and we are absolutely up for it this time around.
How has this election campaign been for you?
It's been crazy, because it's the first time either Steve or I have actually run as a candidate, so it's been a real eye-opener. But it's been incredible, because while the two majors are having their, you know, their argy-bargy both with each other and with the press, we've just been quietly, you know, plugging away, getting the word out, speaking to people on the ground. And the response that we're getting from people on the ground has actually been extraordinary and really gratifying, because a lot of people I bump into go, oh, you're back. Oh, that's fantastic. And which is a level of enthusiasm that, like over the last 2 years with the partisanship and sort of, tribalism of politics on social media, we weren't necessarily expecting, but the average voter out and about just going to vote in pre-poll or where we're door knocking has been enormously receptive to the message that the Australian Democrats are back, which is really great and really promising. The hits that we're getting on our website, like the last 28 days, they've just gone through the roof. They've quadrupled, and that's sort of organic. Like that was before we actually started any kind of social media advertising. So there's clearly an appetite for the Australian Democrats and what we represent, and the function we have served in the past to return to the parliament. Because, I mean, as you and Eddie have noted on the podcast, this government is the most corrupt since World War II. And they're quite overtly
since Federation.
Oh, sorry, I misquoted you. We've sort of said in both internally and to the voting public that Morrison's government isn't like they're not even pretending to govern. They're not even pretending not to be corrupt. They're being quite open about it. And something has to change.
Elena, I think one of the other things that I'm hearing from people is they remember the role of the Australian Democrats as a unifying force.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned earlier, that idea of being a moderating voice. But I also think that there's a role there of bringing different sides of politics together to work on issues. We certainly saw that when we chaired Senate committees. There was often, if not always, consensus opinions formed from those committees about the direction that legislation might take. And at a time when, we've spent probably at least 9 years, but I think in fairness longer than that, with an increasingly divisive national politics, where that gap between the major parties has increased, where their desire to be seen to be working together has diminished almost to zero, the idea of someone playing a role of mediating and moderating and unifying so that politicians are actively working together productively in the national interest, I think is something that's appealing to a lot of people.
Absolutely. I mean, Steve, you and I have spoken in the past, and as an evidence-based party, I'll say correlation does not equal causation. But I don't think it's a coincidence that our national politics has turned into a rolling car crash kind of the moment the Democrats left the building.
I think there was a confluence of things and as well. The wing of the Liberal Party that was represented by people like Nick Minchin and Tony Abbott, who want that anarchic right-wing no government, suddenly had no one to stop them. They neutralised the moderates in their party, and Labor themselves, after about 2010, were imploding. Plus you had the ruthless opposition leadership of Tony Abbott, which was to oppose absolutely everything, whether it made sense to oppose it or not. This kind of worked till he becomes prime minister. And it is interesting this, if there'd been more moderate voices in the Senate, and the Senate had gone very right with the rise of One Nation and some of those others. So there was no one saying, hold on, let's wind this back a little bit.
I think you raise a really interesting point, though, in terms of how the Senate has operated as a body over the last, while, and let's say the last 14 years, because that's since we weren't there, but it hasn't operated with the same kind of constructive, productive relationship between parties. I have some views on why that might be. In opposition, Labor weren't really interested in being a constructive voice and giving the Liberal National Coalition anything. It's not really how the Greens work either in the Senate. Like, that's not really their role. They tend to take a more adversarial approach to things. And you can't expect the likes of individuals like Jackie Lambie or Rex Patrick to make up for that. They're not going to overcome those sorts of large divides and those large dynamics as a group. I think even with, given our legacy, even a small number of Australian Democrat senators would actually have much greater impact than more independents, for example.
And I would like to sort of stress to the listeners that over the last, decade, we've seen what happens to our federal politics without that moderating voice and that moderating sort of purpose of the Democrats in Parliament. And it's not pretty, and it's definitely not working for the country. And so obviously I am biased because I am a Democrat, but I feel very, very strongly, and that's why one of the reasons why I'm running, is that we need to return that moderating voice to the Senate and to the Parliament. And Australia can be so much better than it currently is, both internally, domestically, but also as a global citizen. And we need to do better. And the only way that we can do better is to have better people and better principles back in Parliament. And Steve and I feel very, very strongly that the Democrats are the vehicle by which we can do that for the country. And as Steve said, we're very serious about this, and we're very, very keen to serve the nation again.
That was Elena Mitchell and Steve Beattie from the Australian Democrats. And you can find more details about the Australian Democrats at democrats.org.au. You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or find us at newpolitics.com.au. And you can now support New Politics through Patreon. Up next, we look at the latest opinion polls and answer all of your election questions.
Lying around waiting to die. Never did quite satisfy. A siren song, sugar tongue, so easily undone. Clever enough to know the score. Begging to stop, you say what for? My dark angel, won't you drag those nails across my soul? Across my soul.
The opinion polls have started going into freefall for the coalition, but all of them are showing election losing positions. And depending on which poll you look at, it's ranging between a loss of 15 to 20 seats. And that's before we start looking at the effects of the Teal independents, where each seat they win is a seat taken off the Liberal Party. So a week away from an election, it's not looking very good for Scott Morrison and the Liberal National Coalition. No government has ever been able to win from this position in the electoral cycle. And that's not to say that it can't be done, but it's looking very, very unlikely. And we've mentioned this a few times before, but absolutely everything needs to fall into place for the coalition for them to win the election, but it seems to be falling apart when they need it to be sticking together. During the week, the Federal Environment Minister, Susan Ley, she was asked about what would happen to Regional Development Australia after the election, but she said that she's only focused on what happens in the next 2 weeks of their campaign and not painting a picture of what government might do after the election. Now, she might not be required to paint a picture after the election, because what's going to happen before the election is not a very pretty picture at all.
No. The YouGov poll puts Labor at winning 80 seats, which is a pretty commanding majority. Again, the Liberal strategy seems to be snaffling marginal seats in key areas, even if that means losing a few safe seats. Whether they're taking those seats for granted too, Kooyong, North Sydney, Goldstein, Dixon, or whether there is another underground targeted response that we're not seeing, I don't know. But it would seem to me that if the polling is correct, and we're at margins of error now that are too wide to matter, I don't know that any poll could be 10% out, which some of them seem to be suggesting that type of gain for the Labor Party. The other thing that I've noticed is that it may not be a hung parliament. It may be Labor gets a clear majority and you still have a lot of independents sitting on the crossbenches, but they don't have the balance of power. I'm not prepared to call the election as such, because we don't live in times where the normal formula and rules can apply. I can also see the possibility of a hung Liberal parliament. That would be without Scott Morrison as Prime Minister. I think the only way Scott Morrison keeps his job is if the Liberal Party gets a landslide victory. And I don't think that's going to happen. I can't see it.
Well, all of the opinion polls are either static or moving away from the coalition at the moment, when they actually need to be moving towards the coalition. And if the polls are correct, we're starting to look at landslide territory. And before we start getting all of those emails and messages about remembering 2019, we say this virtually every week. Yes, the polls were wrong in 2019, but the government just doesn't seem to have much of an agenda, and they just don't seem to be getting the message that's coming from the public about certain key issues. Here's Bridget McKenzie and her interpretations of pork barrelling.
Investing and bring you back to the question. I wasn't asking about the Labor Party. This is Stephen Charles, a highly respected former judge. He says pork barrelling, colour-coded spreadsheets, the works is political corruption. What do you say?
Well, Michael, when you're talking about what you would see as pork barrelling is what in the National Party we say is delivering for our electorates.
Okay.
So the public is expecting for something different to be done on anti-corruption measures, and the government seems to be not listening to that message. But if there is an anti-government vote building up, and if the Teal independents do pick up the seats that they're expecting to pick up, and if the current opinion polls do stack up, the coalition could have that negative threefold effect against them after the election. There'll be a Labor majority, the coalition will be way behind in the seats that they hold, and there'll be a buffer of independence between them and being able to form government in future elections. Now, all of this is hypothetical, of course, because it hasn't happened yet. But if it does come to fruition, the future prospects for the coalition are not looking very good, because once those independents become embedded, they're very difficult to remove.
There's one or two things that happen with independents. They lose after the first term, or they're there for years and years and years doing a great job. I guess you're model independent is Clover Moore, who held the seat of Bligh for nearly two decades before she was forced out by some unfair legislation. She was also mayor of Sydney at the same time. Other independents, Tony Windsor, Rob Oakeshott, who held for a couple of terms, somebody like Adam Bandt. The Greens aren't independents as such, but in terms of the numbers of seats they hold, we can count them in the independent grouping. Andrew Wilkie has held his seat for quite some time now too. And again, independents, because they're not as tied to having to maintain a portfolio, can look after their constituents very well. And if you have a strong local presence, you can stay in Parliament a long time. The electorate tends to prefer good candidates. And this is why the Climate 200 independents, the Teal independents, call them what you will, are having a surging in popularity, because a lot of electorates have been ignored by their local member. How many of them get in, we won't know. I suspect a few of them will, and maybe all of them.
Well, over 300,000 people have been voting every day since pre-polling commenced, and over 1 million postal votes have been received. So it's looking like it might get to over 50% of the electorate will have voted before election day. And I've been out to some of the booths in the inner west. Now, some commentators have been saying that there isn't a mood for change out there. It might not be so much a mood for a change, but a feeling of removing this incompetent government. And on the hustings, you do run into a lot of different people. And I ran into one of the minor party candidates that you've interviewed, David, and that was Saha Khalili from the Fusion Party. Saha, it was very good to see you and good luck with your campaign. But this election has got a similar feeling to the 1996 election campaign, when the Queensland Premier at the time, Wayne Goss, he said that the electorate was waiting for Paul Keating with baseball bats, and they certainly were at the time. But also at the time, the opposition leader, John Howard, he wasn't respected, he wasn't loved by the electorate, but the electorate just wanted to remove the Labor government at that time. And John Howard played a very safe game and ended up winning that election quite easily. This election campaign has now got a very similar feeling to it, and similar prevailing circumstances too.
There's a change in the air. Scott Morrison promised things that ultimately he couldn't deliver. Why he couldn't deliver them is a whole other debate, and one that I think will require a little bit of distance. There's some obvious things, of course. Some of you already started shouting at the device you're listening through, and that's all correct. The memoirs that come out of this government may become very interesting. It's probably most reminiscent of the McMahon government in 72, too closely tied to big business. Very few good people left in the party who are capable and wise and considered and competent and not corrupt. Very few seem to be interested. Moving to the Nationals for a bit, Barnaby Joyce's press council talk was appalling. he even stopped halfway through, as if he didn't know what to say and he wasn't even sure why he was there. This is a man who managed to talk his party into having him back because he was a changed man. But it showed that his career was dead after he got sacked and has never really recovered. I don't think he will lose the seat in New England. He's certainly not going to be Nationals leader for much longer. And this is the feeling I'm getting, that the dominant figures of the last 10 years or so have been exposed for the shallow incompetence that they really are at heart, that they're not working for all of Australia, they're working for small parts of Australia. And that when you do that as Prime Minister consistently, you fail. When you do that as government, you fail. And as I said, there's still a chance that they could win. What happens now is that the progressive side gets complacent. Ah, we've won. Look at the lines. There were long lines in 2019. I think in a lot of cases, the long lines are people voting early so they don't have to worry about it on Saturday where they've got other things to do now. You've got to be careful of that. It's going to be very interesting.
We've also got a few questions from our audience. Matt asks us a question through Twitter. In the seat of Nichols, there's a campaign that's going unnoticed, and that's the independent candidate Rob Priestley. And Matt wanted to know if this could be signalling a shift away from the National Party. Nichols is a seat at the top of Victoria, right on the New South Wales-Victoria border, and that includes the towns of Shepparton, Yarrawonga, Seymour and Broadford, and it's a conservative rural area. It's one of the safest seats in Australia. It's held by the National Party by a margin of 40%. There's a few interesting factors in play here. The current member, Damien Drum, he's retiring. The Liberal Party is also fielding a candidate against the National Party, and there's 11 candidates in total. Rob Priestley is a strong and impressive candidate, and we've mentioned in previous episodes that every election contains a surprise, and the seat of Nichols could be one of them.
There's been a shift away from the National Party for a couple of elections. 2019 is looking more and more like an anomaly, I think. The seat includes Shepparton, which has always been a fairly strong National Party seat. Now, the Nationals aren't as dominant in Victoria as they are in New South Wales. That's one thing that's got to be remembered. Although the biggest swing against the National Party was in the seat of Orange, where the Shooters, Fishers and Farmers got in with an immense swing of 30% or something a couple of elections ago. Rob Priestley, I had a look, and you're right, Matt, it has been somewhat of an ignored campaign, but I think he's got a real chance. When the National Party starts to decline, it will decline from Victoria, where it's never been that strong. National Party is really New South Wales. It was Queensland, but they merged with the Liberal Party, which was seen as a weak Liberal Party after the dominant years of Joe Bjelke-Petersen. If Rob is as good as he seems, and again, I'm not endorsing his policies at all. I'm sure we would agree on some things and disagree on some things, but he's not representing me. I'm in the seat of Watson in Sydney. If he's as good as he seems, he could be the first major crack in the dam of National Party influence.
And just the final question, Ellie emailed through another question, and that was about the Liberal Party leadership after the election, who is going to be the leader. Now, we don't want to jump the gun at the moment because the election hasn't been held yet, but hypothetically speaking, Ellie wanted to know if Josh Frydenberg loses his seat and if Peter Dutton loses his seat and if the Coalition lose the election, who will become the leader of the opposition? Because it's unlikely Scott Morrison will remain as the leader. And behind these three people, not that this is a spectacular group of leaders, there's not much there. So we've got some idea about who would become the leader of the opposition if Labor loses the election. It would either be Tanya Plibersek or Jim Chalmers. But if the Coalition loses, it's very unclear who would become their leader.
No one stands out. And this, of course, suits Scott Morrison. Just going through the cabinet now.
Well, there's Dan Dehan, Michael Tudge, Melissa Price, Angus Taylor, Susan Ley, Alex Hawke. There's not actually much there.
Anne Rustin, she's Senator, sorry. It could go to somebody like Karen Andrews. Hawke, Tudge, Robert Taylor are way too tarnished. Hunt's gone. He's not standing again. Melissa Price, I can't really see anyone. A lot of them are just not very good. And even if the party's in total disarray, it's unlikely they'd be elected leader. And I do believe that unless it is a landslide to the Liberal National Party, Scott Morrison won't last long past the election. He's either going to lose government or he's going to be rolled very quickly.
That's it for this episode of New Politics. Thanks for listening in. If you'd like to support our style of journalism and commentary, please make a donation at our website at newpolitics.com.au. We don't beg, plead, beseech, or gaslight you about journalism coming to an end. We just keep it very simple. If you like what we do, please send some support our way. It keeps our commitment to independent journalism ticking along. I'm Eddie Djokovic. Thanks for listening in, and it's goodbye to our listeners.
I'm David Lewis. We'll see you next time.